Okay, thank you. So there have been many talks on leptogenesis already, so I don't know if I have much new to say, but I try to organize it in a bit different way. Maybe. And so I will be talking basically about a very simple problem. I just take an extension of the standard model where I add right-handed neutrinos n gauge singlets in a minimal way, that means with some Majorana masses and then some Yukawa couplings. And so then of course there can be some flavor structure. I will, for the purposes of my talk, I will not really need to discuss much about the flavor structure, but in principle these are matrices and these are matrices in the flavor space. Okay, so the reason for this extension of the standard model is clearly that it offers a simple description of the experimentally observed neutrino masses and mixing angles. It's not the only explanation of this, but it's one of the simple explanations. And so, in particular, if one then breaks the electroweak symmetry, then, as I think everybody knows, then one generates neutrino masses, where B is the Higgs-Wave, and these are the neutrino Yukawas, and this is the mass scale. So now that we are then in this situation, which already was briefly discussed in Friday, that the left-hand side is, these are the known masses, or rather the mass differences are known. But anyway, we know something about the left-hand side. But on the right-hand side, there are two new sets of parameters, the Majorana masses and the Yukawa couplings. So therefore, we can constrain these new parameters, but there are many things which remain open. In particular, the absolute mass scale of the Majorana masses is open from this phenomenological point of view.
Okay, Miki, before you go, I want to understand the structure. So you introduce just only one single new degree of freedom.
Or three. I mean, three generations is also.
Oh, fine. Okay, three generations. Yeah. But for one generation, it's just only one single, and it is not Dirac, it is just
Majorana.
So right, it's only, instead of four, just two.
Yeah.
And if you don't have Yukawa, it would be decoupled, very heavy.
It would be completely decoupled without
Yukawa. Completely decoupled, but very heavy.
Well,
it's proportional to M.
Yeah, I mean, the mass scale is completely open. So I will, on the next slide, I will show some many orders of magnitude that people can sort of consider.
So the basic idea, just because of the Yukawa, you have some kind of mixing with the actually real physical life degrees of freedom.
Exactly, yes.
And L and phi in your notations, it is a lepton?
Yeah, this is the lepton, this is the Higgs.
It is a conventional standard Higgs doublet.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So you do not introduce any new pieces?
No. These are standard model degrees of freedom here. The only new degree of freedom is this.
And AR?
Oh, this is the chiral projection. So this is the left-hand.
Okay, one plus system. Gamma 5.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so since only this combination is constrained, and there are many, many different orders of magnitude for this mass scale that people have considered. I mean, here are like 20 orders of magnitude. And this is not an exclusion plot. This is just some kind of sociological plot. What kind of regions people have considered interesting. So clearly, originally, people thought that right-handed neutrinos are a window to grand unification. Therefore, one considered very heavy mass scales, 10 to 10 GeV or even more. That's then the classic leptogenesis. Then a bit later on, people thought maybe we find something at the TeV scale. But that's also just sociology, basically hoping that one could find something LHC. So there's another window, but it doesn't mean that there wouldn't be anything in between. Probably there's everything in between. Then there's a third philosophy, and that's to say that for some reason there is no physics apart from the weak scale, or there is no physics between the weak scale and the Planck scale. And so then you may want to have this mass scale also at the weak scale or below the weak scale. So there are some other possibilities. One of them is the possibility for producing maybe dark matter with these right-handed neutrinos. And that's actually, the only one here which is really an island, a fairly constrained set of parameters. But I will not really be talking about this now. This is KeV scale. So K, you would see then a KeV X-ray signal if this were dark matter. So I will rather talk. What I will talk about is basically high temperatures higher than the the weak scale, higher than 160 GeV. So that's the temperature range where the electroweak symmetry is restored. So I will talk about these high temperatures, but the mass would then be very small or very large. Basically what I will say applies to all masses. Okay, so since I'm talking about this high temperatures, then the kind of the physics reason one does it, looks at this in cosmologies, then leptogenesis in all these cases. So now for leptogenesis, then, there are, if you want to generate the baryonic symmetry, there are the famous Sakharov conditions that you have to satisfy. Now, of course, these Sakharov conditions, they are not sufficient conditions, they are necessary conditions. And with necessary conditions, I can always introduce more necessary conditions. In particular, if I rephrase my problem a little bit from necessary conditions for baryogenesis to necessary conditions for explaining baryogenesis, for us explaining baryogenesis, then I can easily add to these three well-known conditions a further one, which we also have to satisfy if we want to explain baryogenesis, and that's that we have to be able to compute reliably with this theory that I introduced and with all these ingredients put in. Okay, so now why do I do this? Well, I want to kind of argue that, I mean, there are these two conditions which are very famous, baryon number violation and in particular CP violation. These are, of course, these are important conditions, and also people have been fascinated by these conditions for a long time because this is something which is unique to quantum field theory. Baryon number violation is even a non-perturbative feature in quantum field theory. CP violation is not non-perturbative, but still it's a very peculiar and interesting feature of quantum field theory. So somehow, these are kind of traditionally what one really finds fascinating, and whereas the other two, that means non-equilibrium and also this able to compute reliably in statistical physics, these are things which are nothing special to quantum field theory. These are problems which people are faced with even in normal statistical physics. So somehow traditionally one thought these two first things to be really worth looking at and these other two sort of mundane things. So what I want to kind of argue is that now we are in a situation where we, even though these are very delicate issues, we do understand them rather well today. Particularly baryon number violation, for instance, the standard model, we understand numerically. Well, we don't understand it analytically, we don't compute analytically, but numerically we understand it on a percent level, so to say, the rate of baryon number violation in the standard model. CP violation also we understand well, theoretically. We may not have depends on the model, of course. There's model dependence, but apart from model dependence, we understand it well. But for non-equilibrium and for this the way of computing, there we are still kind of rather not very far. And so I would like to today take these two topics and try to somehow organize a little bit what we could try to do there. So I will start with the non-equilibrium. And for me, I mean, somehow I would call this kind of a conceptual challenge of how one handles non-equilibrium problems. And the reason that it's a conceptual challenge is that it's kind of rather difficult even to define in a general way what we mean by deviation from equilibrium. So equilibrium is a unique state, so to say. We just give a density matrix which is parameterized by the temperature, and then everything is, all the observables are in principle defined. But of course, non-equilibrium, there are infinitely many ways to be out of equilibrium. For some of these, we have given names, but it doesn't mean that's an exhaustive list. And also some of these classes, like kinetic non-equilibrium, you can be in kinetic non-equilibrium in infinitely many different ways. So somehow it's even difficult to specify the state of your system if you are in a general way out of equilibrium. So, however, then there is a basic principle which says that if you take this complicated system and if you let it evolve, then with time this system, it does relax back to equilibrium. And this is maybe even a bit of a tautology in the sense that equilibrium is kind of by definition the most likely configuration. So if you wait for a while and there are interactions, then after a while you are certainly going to find yourself in a neighborhood of a likely configuration. So that's one thing one can say. One can be a bit more precise, and that statement is that this relaxation towards equilibrium, that's usually characterized by a rate. And this rate is a microscopic property of the system. It depends on what kind of interactions there are, which try to even out these deviations from equilibrium. And it also depends very much on the type of non-equilibrium. So all these named non-equilibrium situations, they typically have very different equilibration rates. So with this concept of an equilibration rate, one can try to be then a little bit more concrete. And so this is kind of the cartoon that we have normally in cosmology. So what's plotted here is the age of the universe. So early times, high temperatures, late times, low temperatures. And here is a rate, then maybe in units of temperature or so. And so what I plotted here is then two types of rates. One rate is the black line is the Hubble rate. And so that's the external time scale at which the universe expands and cools down. And that's what drives us out of equilibrium. And then I compare that with some of these microscopic rates for maybe different types of deviations from equilibrium. And so now then there are two possibilities. A given rate may be even either larger than the Hubble rate or smaller than the Hubble rate. And now in each situation, if you are sufficiently far away from the Hubble rate, then physics is simple. So if your equilibration rate is much faster than the Hubble rate, then this means that these processes happen very, very often during the Hubble time. And then therefore these degrees of freedom are actually in equilibrium, a very good approximation. And that's then a simple situation. Again, we know how to describe that. Another simple situation is if the rate is much smaller than the Hubble rate. Because what that means is simply that there is this some observable which is out of equilibrium, but nothing happens. Basically, this observable doesn't interact. That's what it means, the rate is small. It doesn't interact within the Hubble rate. So for instance, baryon number today, in principle, is violated, but the rate is so much smaller than in practice, it's a conserved charge. And so for all these guys which are comfortably out of equilibrium, one has a conserved charge, and conserved charge is also simple. And so what is really non-trivial is then when these two rates are somehow of the same order of magnitude. And that's where something interesting happens. So that's what I try to describe briefly. And so, of course, the most interesting situation for cosmology is this kind of a curve where in the beginning everything is for sure after inflation, or so everything is out of equilibrium. But if this deviation we are looking at, if it enters equilibrium at some point, then that's very nice, because then in equilibrium, comfortably in equilibrium, one loses memory of the initial conditions, and that's very nice. Then we can understand this in terms of physics at some scales here, and then at some late moment we again non-equilibrate and generate some remnant. For instance, dark matter is generated like this in many models, or maybe then lepton asymmetry. So that's now what I want to look at. And so if one draws it like this, then what one would say is that in a normal situation you have one degree of freedom which is interesting at a time. Maybe if you're lucky there may be two which are nearby, but normally you have only a few things which cross this curve in a similar temperature range. So in fact the simplest scenario is that there is indeed only one interesting variable. So now for generating a lepton number, what it would mean is that now I can, if I am close to equilibrium here, and if I look at some quantity like the lepton number, which has a discrete symmetry, it's Cp odd, then this means that its expectation value in equilibrium would be zero. So in equilibrium, the value would be zero. Now if I'm close to equilibrium, what I look at is then the evolution, how I approach the equilibrium. If I look at the approach sort of on the average at long time scale, then I can imagine that I put here a derivative. I look at the derivative. And then on the right hand side, I simply expand in deviations from equilibrium. So this is a very general statement. I'm not making any particular approximation here. It really follows just from the fact that I know that if I waited long enough, I really would be in equilibrium. And so then the coefficient of the first term here, I just define as some gamma, some rate. So that's what I would like I would write in Minkowski space-time cosmology. We have an expansion, so we have to modify the time derivative, but it's really, everybody knows here how to do that. And then one can rewrite it as a co-moving expansion. A is the scale factor. And so if I write it now like this, then it's the same form as the first equation. And this is the first order equation with a positive coefficient here. This has only one solution, namely a decaying solution. And what it means that if you really only have one variable, then the dynamics is very trivial. You can put in some initial condition, but if you wait, then with this rate gamma L, you then equilibrate to zero in this case. So in particular, you equilibrate always, you cannot generate anything in this situation. So now what's remarkable is that you have to modify this extremely simple dynamics only very little to get something interesting for cosmology. And that's sort of the second most minimal scenario. That means that I take two variables. So I take now this lepton number here, but then in addition, I take the number density, or if you want to be precise, it's maybe the energy density, really, but I represent the energy density now here as number density of right-handed neutrinos, because they are very weakly coupled, so I expect that at some point they are again falling out of equilibrium. So it's a number density, energy density particles plus antiparticles. It's CP, it's a CP even perturbation. That means that it has a non-zero expectation value in equilibrium, but otherwise the form of the equations is just the same. I take the same principle, I put on the left-hand side the time derivatives, on the right-hand side, then I have to take a matrix, because I have two variables now, and then I omit high-order terms. So now, again, this is somehow the general form. And now with this general form, this very simple dynamics, I already can do something non-trivial. Namely, what happens now is that...
Just a short question. And Lagrangian, which describes this dynamics, how does it look like?
So this is the same Lagrangian I had before. So this is, I haven't really, to write this equation, I haven't assumed anything about the dynamics yet. The dynamics really comes when I try to then compute these coefficients, gamma. But this is just from general principles of statistical physics that my system equilibrates if I wait long enough. I identify the degrees of freedom. I choose initial conditions that such that everything else is in equilibrium, and I only identify some degrees of freedom which are not, and I follow the dynamics. And from general principles, I say that close enough to equilibrium, this is the form of the equation I have.
But somehow they mix, so it means that there is an interaction between these two species.
I allow for interaction. Of course, it might happen that there is some secret reason that one of the coefficients is zero, but in general, these coefficients would not be zero.
So you assume that in your Lagrangian, there is an interaction term between the two pieces.
There will be, in general, there will be. If for some reason there is not, then the corresponding coefficient is zero.
Gamma Ln is interaction between L and N, right?
Yeah, gamma Ln is an interaction between how N generates L, and Ln is how L generates N. So why is this interesting? Well, this is interesting because now, if I assume that these guys have a mass, like right-handed neutrinos have a mass, then if I go to a very small temperature, then eventually I know that temperature is much less than mass, their number density necessarily becomes, the equilibrium number density necessarily becomes small. And so when the temperature falls below the mass scale, it really starts to become very, very small very fast. So now if I look at these equations, what it means that if I evolve these equations in cosmology and if I fall below this temperature scale, then this guy is changing rapidly, it's becoming rapidly small. Now I have a coefficient here which is trying to keep the actual solution close to this one by this coefficient. It's trying to evolve the number density such that the solution remains close to this one. But if this really evolves exponentially fast, and this is a finite coefficient, then at some point it cannot do the work anymore. At some point, in particular because there is no reason for this guy to have an exponential factor. This is caused by interactions between these guys with the standard monoparticles. There's no exponential enhancement here in general. And so that means that when you really, then at some point when this is not strong enough to enforce n to be close to the equilibrium value, then this guy here also deviates from equilibrium. And this means that now I have a first order equation for the lepton number, but it has a source term. And once it has a source term, then you have a non-trivial solution for the lepton number. So it's extremely simple way of explaining why you get a lepton asymmetry. It's just you need one degree of freedom which falls out of equilibrium and couples with a lepton number. So that's the famous scenario of Menagiran from Gida. So this is kind of a cartoon, the simplest possible cartoon. Now, of course, there are many less minimal scenarios, and many talks here have concerned less minimal scenarios. So I can replace, for instance, the number density of some particle by a phase-based distribution, which also depends on the momentum in a non-thermal way, then I would have not only chemical non-equilibrium, but also kinetic non-equilibrium. I could introduce spin degrees of freedom, which has not, to my knowledge, been considered very prominently. What is considered oftentimes is flavor transitions. This is in particularly important in context when one introduces CP violation. Another important issue is if you happen to have two particles which have almost the same mass, it can happen that one is in a regime where there's quantum coherence. And quantum coherence necessarily modifies the form of these equations a little bit, because what I have written here is the form of these equations is basically a classical form. And the classical form in a statistical system, that is a good approximation if you have lots of time for interactions in the time scale of your solution. I mean, if many interactions happen between a macroscopic evolution of your variables. But if you have a resonance, then this may not necessarily be the case. You might have to write some kind of a form which also tracks phase information, and then one would have a more complicated solution. Also, of course, one can imagine initial conditions where one is not close to equilibrium, but one would have to go to quadratic deviations or higher orders. So, however, what I want to stress is that even if one considers these more general scenarios, then still it doesn't mean that I can still view it in this language. I can still view it in this language that I identify the degrees of freedom which are interesting. Everything else is simple. And then I write down the most general dynamics for these interesting degrees of freedom. And that dynamics involves coefficients. And then the next step is I have to compute these coefficients. So what this philosophy achieves, if one formulates it in this way, is that it really factorizes the problem into two completely different parts. So I kind of understand what I mean by the non-equilibrium feature. And then all these computational challenges are now, first of all, they are in the computation of these coefficients. That's what I will discuss in the next part. And then, of course, it's in the solution of these differential equations. But that is trivial because it's just first order differential equations, maybe with some nonlinear terms, but still these are very simple to solve. So really the challenges are in the computation of the coefficients. And so now if one takes a more complicated scenario, one has many more coefficients and one has more work to do. But still, I think it would be very useful if one would always try to formulate the problem in this language, that one kind of tries to state clearly in the beginning what is the non-equilibrium scenario one is considering. So sometimes it happens that these two aspects, the non-equilibrium aspect and then the aspect of how you compute some coefficients, that these are kind of intertwined. Maybe one chooses a formalism which one knows and uses, and then one kind of defines almost the problem within the formalism. But this really, I think it would be very nice if one would always try to formulate these two issues separately, the non-equilibrium aspects and then what is really trying to compute. Okay, so this was somehow my propaganda concerning the non-equilibrium aspect. So what I will then try to discuss next is the computation of these coefficients, of some of these coefficients, and I will take one of these coefficients first, this gamma n. And this gamma n is oftentimes it's known as the right-handed neutrino production rate. And the reason is that if I'm in the regime of validity of these equations, and if I then take an initial, I mean theoretically, so theoretician I can always choose my initial conditions as I wish. So in particular, I could choose an initial condition where in the beginning there is no lepton number. I could put this to zero. I could put this to zero, and I could also choose a situation where the initial number density, n here, is much less than the equilibrium number density. Well, if this is much less than this, then the difference here is negative, and with a minus here, it's positive. So I will then produce right-handed neutrinos, and this gamma n would then be the rate of production of right-handed neutrinos. So I will take that as an example, and I will try to discuss the challenges that we are faced with there. Okay, so now the basic point is once I have identified, once I've formalize my non-equilibrium problem in this language, then for the computation of these coefficients gamma n, I can choose simple initial conditions. Because the values of the coefficients are always the same. I mean, the dynamical solution depends on the initial conditions, but the values of the coefficients are the same within the range of validity of this description. So in particular, I can take initial conditions where my variables in the beginning are arbitrarily close to equilibrium. And this means that these coefficients actually are properties of equilibrium. You can compute them arbitrarily close to equilibrium, therefore they are properties of equilibrium. So in particular, the leading order in the Yukawa couplings, this coefficient gamma n is really related to the two-point function of these right-handed neutrinos, which I denote by this kind of a double line. Two-point function then has the Higgs and the leptons in the loop, and then these interact with the standard model degrees of freedom, so I've indicated it with this kind of colored plasma. So in this plasma, there can be all kinds of standard model degrees of freedom, W, bosons, set zero, bosons, and whatnot. And the rate is then the cut of this, is the imaginary part of this, this self-energy. And the four momentum of this right-handed neutrino that is being produced, I denote by K, and it has then the mass and then the momentum. So now
you actually compute Whiteman-Green's function. You
I could also
a Whiteman.
Yeah, I could also say it like that. Yes, I mean really what this cut is a spectral function. So it's a
Whiteman-Green's function.
It's a part of the Whiteman-Green function. Whiteman-Green function in general has a real part and has a real part and an imaginary part. And so this cut is the imaginary part.
That's imaginary part positively defined.
Okay. Now. To discuss the problem, I first have to say what the scales are that I'm now considering. So I said in the beginning, I'm now considering high temperature. So therefore, the Higgs value is zero. So I don't have any zero temperature mass scales in my problem. So I assume that the standard model plasma is completely characterized by temperature. Somehow I like to put the pi times temperature, but it's really like a temperature scale. And then there are interactions. And I somehow denote by G kind of collectively all standard model couplings, so both gauge couplings and Yukawa couplings. And so these, in the standard model plasma, these interactions, then they introduce some other scale, some whatever D by scale or so. So there are these other scales generated by interactions, but in general, these are scales proportional to temperature. So that's one scale or two scales, if you want to be more precise. And then there is the other scale, which is the M. And this M is the mass of the right-handed neutrinos that I'm producing. And that only appears in this one point. It appears in the fact that I'm producing on-shell right-handed neutrinos. So it appears in the dispersion relation here. It doesn't have any back reaction on the properties of the plasma in this approximation. This is the only approximation I'm really making, that I'm treating the right-handed neutrino Yukawa to the first non-trivial order. But standard model interactions are treated in principle to all orders. Of course, in practice, I will make an expansion in a later moment. So now I have these, say, two scales. And so if I have two scales in quantum field theory, then usually it implies already that I will have a problem somewhere. And the problem, in particular, will appear when the ratio of the scales is large or small. Maybe, so I will start now with a simpler situation, which is low temperatures, or large masses, or late universe. What I want to understand why there is a difficulty, I just kind of start very simple-mindedly. I start computing corrections. So this is the leading order process for producing these right-handed neutrinos in a standard model plasma. It's a Higgs and a lepton come together. Higgs and leptons are in this plasma with their Boltzmann distributions. So there's a certain probability for them to come together and form a right-handed neutrino. That's the simplest process. But now I draw some corrections to this process. So I can have virtual corrections, like the vertex correction. I can have corrections to the propagators. But then I can also have, in a plasma, I can have real corrections, because in a plasma there are also, there are W gauge bosons. And also I can consider scattering. So I don't need to have this right-handed neutrino as the lone state in the final state. It can also be just part of the final state. So these 2x2 scatterings are also very important. In these scatterings, one produces this right-handed neutrino, and then something else, and this something else is again part of the thermal medium, but it doesn't matter. This is the one which I'm trying to compute, how many of those are produced. Okay, this is not an exhaustive list, it's some example, characteristic examples. But what's important is that, like also in phenomenology, that you have virtual corrections and then you have real corrections. And one already expects that there is some...
And you don't touch quarks at this point.
Actually, I also have quarks. So here I only drew gauge corrections, but now I will want to show one example, and that is precisely with the quark. This is kind of the simplest process maybe you can take. So now I take this guy and Higgs, I put here a top loop with the Yukawa couplings here. So
the reason why I'm asking, because once you have quarks, in this case you have soft gluons, lot of them.
Yeah. I mean, I also have here, so these are...
Not only W, which are massive, but soft light gluons.
Now I have to say, I'm really at the high temperature, higher than 160 GeV. So electron weak symmetry is restored. So actually W's and Z0's are kind of like gluons. Oh, they are also massless. There are many of them, and that will be very important in a moment.
The same.
Here is a top loop, and of course here you could put gluons, and they may also be very important.
But I mean, just not only in the loop gluons, but like light free particles.
Yeah, sure. There are gluons, like there are...
Like gauge bosons,
like
which
are emitted. There are gluons, like there are W's.
Like this one.
I mean, the only thing is that the Higgs and the lepton, they don't have a strong charge, so they don't couple at this order yet.
Yeah, but at the higher order. You have a loop, in this case you do have.
Okay, so I want to consider this is now the loop, and then I need to take a cut. So now let me point out the following. It's not so important what I write here precisely, but one thing which is important is that now for a moment, I mean, since I'm at high temperature, everything is massless, but I put here somewhere on this line, I choose to put sort of a small regulator mass lambda, and I send this lambda then to zero afterwards. Well, why do I do that? Well, now when I take a cut, I can take two cuts. I can cut here, or I can cut here. So I have a virtual correction. So a three-level amplitude and an interference term with one of the one-loop amplitudes. Let's see if I cut here, and this is another cut where I cut here and then just draw these lines apart. So that's one of these two Toulouse scatterings. Just amplitude squared of that scattering. So now I have a virtual correction and a real correction. So now there are somehow many things to say about this, which are on one hand very well known and very simple. On the other hand, always when you do it for the first time in a new situation, it's also a little bit tricky. So what is important is that actually if you look at these two diagrams separately, then they are divergent if one sends lambda to zero. So this divergence here, if this is a massless quark, and this is a soft divergence, comes just from the softness part of the phase space of this virtual top quark. Here there is a collinear divergence if lambda is very, very small. At zero temperature is well known, is the KLM theorem, that if you take this soft and collinear divergences, you have to take both of them into account. When you sum them, your logarithmic divergence is cancelled and everything is finite. At finite temperature, I'm not aware of a similar theorem, and it turns out that at finite temperature there are more divergences. There are not only these logarithmic divergences, but in general, in particular if you have bosonic loops, in general you have also power-like divergences with lambda in these two diagrams. But still, it has been verified for all these to this order. I mean, there's no general theorem, I believe, so far it's only been verified order by order, but to this order, it's been verified that even with a bosonic case, if you add these together, then also these thermal divergences, they cancel.
And how do you do infrared regularization? You just put lambda?
Here I just put lambda.
But it is not gauge invariant regularization.
Yeah, no. I mean, one could do it many ways, but at the end of the day, since it cancels, it should be fine. But in practice, if you do it a computation like this, that you separate these two, then you really have to regulate them somehow. You could also try to do it with dimensional regularization, but it gets rather difficult that way. So it's kind of simpler to do it.
So for me, it's quite non-trivial what you're saying. You're saying that in non-Abelian gauge field theory, you put lambda into your computations, and there is no lambda dependence at the very end.
Yes.
And for example, when you have external lag gauge field, And you also put lambda.
No. I mean, my external field is here always gauge invariant. So this is this singlet neutrino. This is gauge invariant. All these gauge degrees of freedom are here inside and there.
Only in a loop.
Yeah.
But you know that the loop and external gauge field are related to each other.
Yeah. But there is no external gauge field. There is only this gauge singlet.
What if you were having instead of top quark radiation, gauge quark?
Yeah.
Radiation,
just when you consider radiation of gauge quark,
it would be external.
I mean, okay. So. Yeah. So in this interpretation, you can interpret it as an external gauge field. And here you can interpret it as an external Higgs. But really, my physical observable, I'm looking at a certain physical observable. My physical observable is an infrared sense of, is a gauge invariant observable. So of course, if I look at some other observable, I may have a problem. I mean, this cancellation of divergence is only guaranteed for infrared sense physical observables.
So I think the point is, it's really always the left diagram, it's just a different cut.
No, but what I'm saying that just in gauge field theories, you always have some kind of infrared divergences which cancel between external gauge emission and something which is in the loop, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, there is no cancellation.
Yeah.
Right now, you consider some kind of...
No. The thing on the right is effectively a tree-level amplitudes squared.
Yeah.
The thing on the right is inference of tree number. Yeah. It's just formulating in terms of the scattering term in the kinetic equations. It looks like the same thing as loop angles, but it's really one loop versus. Yeah.
So there is no radiation here at all.
Well,
no, there is. No,
I mean, these are really radiated.
But in addition to this radiation, I consider gauge boson. In addition to that,
yeah.
Can I?
Yeah, sure. You can replace this by a gauge boson, yes. And this you would also replace by a gauge boson.
But in this case, for sure, you
well,
have
okay,
an actually
I mean,
infrared problem.
No, I mean, it's still cancelled. If you
still
do
it. Cancelled,
yeah.
Even for gauge bosons.
Yeah, I mean, here you would have a... Well, it, of course, with the gauge bosons...
Yeah. I mean, it's KLN at zero temperature.
Yeah. I mean, so KLN is really guarantees this at zero, the zero temperature part, but that it happens also at finite temperature. I don't have a general proof for that. I mean, that's only that has been verified in practice. Yeah.
Is there any you were attributing to the virtual quark loop, you were attributing only
soft divergence. Yeah.
Is that true, or is there also
it's true.
Divergence?
Well, it's true. No, I mean, it's true. There is a logarithmic term here, and the logarithmic term, well, if the logarithmic term, it has a, so there's a logarithmic ultraviolet divergence, but the logarithmic integral also is sensitive to the soft quark, so there is a logarithmic.
Oh, right, but I thought there's also in the virtual loop, there's a collinear contribution.
Collinear and soft in both.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure whether you said that or.
Yeah. Okay, I don't know. I don't want to enter. I mean, I didn't.
They get zero temperature. They get regulated by different things in experiments.
Yeah.
And the soft gets regulated by the energy group resolution, and the collinear gets regulated by the angular resolution.
Yeah.
There's really different limits.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But the physics from all these devices, the way how you do measurements, actually enter your answer.
Right. Zero temperature now.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know.
Yeah. I mean, here it
has this external.
Yeah, here it's very important that you have really defined a physical observable, which is gauge invariant, singlet. I mean, if you would do this for something else, sometimes people consider things like in QCD gluon production, or here you could W, and then I don't know what happens. But
you're
here I'm really sure that this is a gauge invariant physical observable, and then I'm not surprised that this happens, but I don't have a.
Well, the observable is just a rate.
Yeah, it's a rate. Yeah, but it's a physical rate. It's really it's gauge invariant. Okay, so why is this important? Well, we see it's very interesting in any case, but it also it's important because sometimes one may make an approximation. For instance, sometimes in a Boltzmann equation, one typically only thinks about this kind of real matrix element squared. So you might forget about this. Or sometimes it's nice to just consider self-energy corrections, loops. You might think that top only, I mean, somehow gives it maybe a mass correction or so, but otherwise it's not so important, so you might forget about this. But so what's now important is that because there is this important cancellation, so if you somehow forget one of them, you can get a very large correction if you miss the cancellation.
So you're trying to say that in a consistent Boltzmann equation, You want to make sure that the infrared safety is enforced,
yeah,
including all of the parts that will be canceling.
If you,
what we call a collision term.
If you would formulate it in Boltzmann equation, you would have to be aware that there might be this, yeah, kind of
Boltzmann part.
Yeah, yeah. So it's very, I mean, if you don't, so in other words, let's put it like this. If you try to estimate the size of radiative corrections by an incomplete computation, only taking into account some effects, then you may largely overestimate the size of radiative corrections. That may also, of course, it may also underestimate it, but you may also overestimate it. If you happen to pick up a correction which is actually sensitive to some infrared scale and you regulate it in some funny way. So it's important to get a good answer. It's important to include everything too.
Do you know any examples where people have made this kind of mistake?
I believe there are many. I mean, I don't want to say any names or so.
That's true, because your time is recorded. You know,
I mean, actually, yeah.
But I'm just curious, are there any places where...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even in this leptogenesis, there are... This has happened, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it typically they've overestimated the corrections? Or
they, yeah, they have over... Often, they have. I mean, there are cases where they have overestimated corrections. So they have missed this cancellation, and then they have put some regulator, and then they have got a very large correction. That has happened. I mean,
which is infrared dependent.
Yeah, yeah.
But they see infrared dependent, they supposed to say stop, something wrong.
Okay, but this sometimes, if you just, you know, try to make an estimate, you may not. You just want to get some estimate, and you may, you know, you may not notice. So, I mean,
people like to enter thermal masses as a regulator.
Yeah.
And this thermal masses also occur in these calculations, but among other contributions.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so the whole business where they put the thermal masses on the leptons and on the Higgs field to show that at some point there is no production, and then, I mean,
yeah, so
some cancellation.
Well, you just blocking.
Yeah, yeah, but
yeah,
so
we will,
the rate is,
yeah, yeah.
We'll so probably show.
I will come back to somehow how one really does thermal masses in a moment. But so what I wanted to say now here is I'm really doing a simple-minded computation, no resummation yet. But I know, now I noticed that I have to do it consistently. However, if I do it consistently, then I tell you that if I do it consistently, I both sum both processes together, then the limit can be taken. It's a smooth limit. And it gives me a finite answer. And so this finite answer has a zero temperature part, which is some related particle renormalization. And then there is an additional thermal part, this phi t. And this, so in the zero temperature limit with fixed momentum, this guy would go to zero. But non-zero temperature is in general non-zero. So now it so happens that now I know this function. I cannot give you an analytic expression, but there is a two-dimensional integral representation, so I can plot this function. So let me plot what happens with this function. So I plot this function here, phi, and I plot this as function of m over t. So m over t means here is a small, mass is small compared with temperature. So temperature is large compared with mass here. So large temperature is here, sort of early universe is here. Here, mass over temperature is large, so it's kind of late universe. And so now one just sees that so this black continuous line is the answer. And so it diverges. So more precisely, this divergence like this, kt cubed over n to the fourth. So it's a strong divergence if I increase the temperature. And so in particular, this was an X2 leading order correction. So I wrote here this guy without some couplings, but so this comes at the X2 leading order. So in my full result, this is multiplied by some coupling, G squared. And now what happens then is that if I choose temperature large enough, then I can compensate for this G. I can make this correction, I can make it larger than the leading order term. Just by taking temperature large enough compared with m. I can make it arbitrarily large, I can make it larger than g, 1 over g squared, if temperature is larger than m over, well, k is of order t, normally. So I can, if temperature is larger than m over square root of g, then this is so large that it cancels any factor which I may have in front of it, and it's larger than the tree level result. So this is what is the breakdown of the loop expansion at finite temperature. So the breakdown is not that you would have integrals which are divergent. Every integral you can evaluate, and if you blindly plot the result, you get a result. But you have to realize that you get the loop corrections, which actually overtake any kind of perturbative factors which you had in front, and therefore you may get the breakdown of the loop expansion.
So isn't this sort of what you're doing with what's going on in the Bayesian?
Yeah, yeah, that's also one of the, so I will now come, move towards the resummation. So now I, before I then explain how one really should do it in this regime, give kind of an intermediate summary. So it so happens that this dominant divergence here, that is fairly trivial, well, not trivial, that's fairly easy to cure. And the dominant divergence turns out indeed be a mass, thermal mass resummation. You can account for that with mass resummation. However, even if I say, if I take the T, if I count K as T, then it's T to the fourth. So even if I take from there the T to the fourth term, then I still have subnominant divergence. It's like T squared, which also has the same problem. And those are more difficult to cure, but that's what I come to. But before I go there, I just show now a result. So here is a result for actually for this, what I denoted by gamma n, actually somehow it's a type of, it's gamma n, again as a function of m over t, so high temperature, low temperature. So this dotted curve here is what would happen if I would just do a thermal mass resummation and then do a leading order computation with those thermal masses. So I argue that this dominant divergence issue may be able to account for in that way. So you get these results. And this red dashed line is what happens if I do the full next to leading order. So if I keep also the subdominant terms, I do the thermal mass resummation, but then I keep all the other terms as well. And so I get this curve. And so one sees that, I mean, there is a regime at low temperatures, late universe, where things are under control. But then at very early times, this mass resummation does mean something, but it's by far not the complete result. Well, I don't know if this is either a complete result, because if I have a correction, which is a very large, from leading order to next to leading order, then I wouldn't know what happens. So it turns out that this solid backline, however, is the correct result in this regime. And so it happens to be pretty close to this one. Now I come to what is the correct procedure here in this regime.
OK, but should the lines then meet somewhere?
Yeah, very good. Excellent. So this is here I have a reliable computation in the low temperatures. Leading order next to leading order correction is small. I trust this computation. This, I argue, is the correct computation at very high temperatures. But this computation is based on an effective theory, which actually breaks down in the opposite limit. It breaks down here. So it doesn't meet this one. Now, the correct result, obviously, should agree with this line at high temperatures, and then it should somehow interpolate here. And that remains to be worked out. I believe it can be worked out.
Why there is a pain point for
Sorry, why there is?
There is a pain point. Yeah.
This is because of a mass threshold. So if you do a, if you have a mass threshold with this mass resummation, it's really not, it's already here, it's not systematic, so to say, because you have a, I mean, in a full result, you certainly the full result will be a smooth function somehow here.
And by a full result, do you mean like next to next leading order?
Full result is a result, yeah, so something which is consistent. So here, yeah, I mean, so this is consistent at leading order. This is at leading order consistent here, but then at some, here it's not consistent, it mixes orders.
Yes, yes.
This is leading order next to leading order. If you would have now somehow, I don't know.
I guess I'm asking is, yeah, take another N.
Yeah.
Would that give you enough satisfaction?
Let me put it like this. I don't think you need to do any further loops. What you have to do in this regime is to be very careful with your resummations. You have to be sure. I mean, here I kind of did some resummation by doing the thermal mass resummation. The thermal mass resummation cured something, but not really the complete thing. I think in this regime somehow, what is really a problem is you don't have a consistent resummation. This resummation is geared to be correct here. Here you don't need a resummation. In this regime, you need some resummation, but you have to figure out what is the correct way to resum the perturbative series.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so let me now come to this regime. So parametrically, this means that the mass is small compared with G times T. Temperature is very large compared with the mass. And now, the correct way to proceed in this regime is really, the physics is not new. So this physics is the physics of LPM effect. LPM is Landau, Brommer, Migdal. And so this physics was developed long time ago in the context of high-energy cosmic rays. High-energy cosmic rays when they enter the atmosphere is like a thermal bath, and then they, what happens is that for this cosmic ray to do anything substantial, it undergoes lots and lots of soft scatterings. And all these soft scatterings, they can even be coherent sometimes. You have to take into account these soft scatterings coherently. It has also been studied actually experimentally. That's kind of funny, with some beam dump experiment, had slack. I think just shooting electrons in some beam dump and seeing what comes out. But somehow in the modern language, it was really kind of revived about 15 years ago in the context of QCD. And then much later in the context of this problem in cosmology. So
QCD calculation and the measurement are consistent?
So this is QED. I mean, this is QED.
It would be interesting to perhaps formulate these LPM calculations with thermal field theory or closed Tampere formalism, because I mean, after all, the atmosphere or the beam dump is different from a relativistic plasma.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know whether it's best to be done.
Yeah, I mean, okay. So let me put it like this, that I haven't looked up into what kind of theoretical work was available at this time from the QED side. Now, these QCD computations also, they have evolved a lot, so it's still, I will try to give some flavor, but I mean, it's not completely transparent. I mean, one can say work, but it's not completely transparent to kind of write it in a language which you can put it in a grad course. So I don't know. Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is there's certainly room for trying to formulate it in a very simple way, more simple way than presently. I agree on that. Yeah. Okay. So what goes on? So I just draw some diagrams now. So this is again the leading order contribution. So the Higgs and lepton go together, form this right-handed neutrino. So now we know that we have to do. I've argued just by doing a stupid computation next to leading order, I've identified that there are some terms, and these cause the loop expansion to break down. So this means I have to do some resummation. So now there is one resummation which is famous, HDL-Hartzell-Mahle loop resummation, and that is a resummation which is somehow very similar in spirit to what we are used to from from field theories at zero temperature. So what the HDL says is that you have to correct all your propagators and all your vertices by some thermal propagators, thermal self-energies, and thermal vertices. So here it's simple. I just add some blob here, which means now I have a thermal mass, but not only a thermal mass, some other structure, well, in particular with leptons, some other structure, and then thermal vertex. However, what happens now, the first interesting thing which happens now, which was already alluded to, is that when the Higgs then gets a thermal mass for the GT, then if I really make the temperature very high, as I said that I want to make, then this Higgs becomes very heavy, and in particular the right-handed neutron, it doesn't really get a thermal mass because it only interacts with the Yukawa. The Yukawa is a very small, I assume it to be a very small coupling. So the mass of this mass stays put, but the Higgs mass, effective mass, increases with the temperature. So therefore I could say that another channel opens up when eventually the Higgs thermal mass is much heavier than this mass, then maybe this channel opens up. Well, of course it assumes that the Higgs mass must also be heavy compared with the lepton mass, but this turns out to be the case, among other things, because for the Higgs you have a top quark, but for the lepton you don't have. So really this is numerically larger than the lepton, therefore this other channel opens up. So this is somehow what, I mean, I think like anyone who is familiar with effective field theories, one could immediately draw these diagrams, and I mean, they must be there somehow. But now, so what this LPM says that this is unfortunately not everything, and it's not even necessarily dominant physics. And so what is really the problem is that you have other processes here, which have nothing to do with mass generation or a vertex correction, but they are just soft scatterings, like with this cosmic ray in the atmosphere. So in this plasma, you have tons of particles, of all kinds of particles, quarks, gluons, gauge bosons. Now I can take any of these lines, and this can just scatter with a very soft scattering. So there is kind of let's say there are these particles in the plasma, they generate electric fields, very soft electric fields, and these particles, by electric I mean not only electric in the electromagnetic sense, but so just charged particles in the gauge group, also in SU2. And these guys have a charge in this gauge group, so therefore they can scatter on these soft fields. So they can scatter, this can scatter, this can scatter, you can have additional scatterings. And now the problem is that these scatterings, they don't cost anything. I mean, you would say that there are additional G's here from the vertices, but then this guy is a hard guy from a plasma, some quark or whatever lepton, which just has a velocity, energy proportional to temperature. So there are many of them, and the integral over the momenta gives some t squared factor. And this gauge boson here can be arbitrarily soft. There is no, there's no phase space suppression there. The phase space is in these particles, not here. So this can be arbitrarily soft. If it's soft, it's only regulated by some thermal mass, maybe. It doesn't need to be exactly a thermal mass, just parametrically a thermal mass. And so one sees that if one adds something like that, then it really doesn't cost anything. It's an order one effect. And so that's the physics then, that one has to account for all these effects. They are there, but then in addition, one has to account for all these soft scatterings, which are enhanced by the fact that there are these soft gauge fields in the game. And that's then the challenge. So that's basically what I won't then explain anymore about how it's done. I think for those who, actually what happens is kind of similar. If you are familiar with non-relativistic systems, if you have a, let's say, quarkonium or positronium or whatnot, then you have a quark and anti-quark. And if they move slowly, or if it's a bound state, then they can exchange lots of gauge fields in between. And what this does is it generates a potential. So at the end of the day, to see what happens to quarkonium states close to threshold or top TT bar production close to thresholds, there is an effect from solving a Schrödinger equation with a potential. So in this situation, these are not non-relativistic. On the contrary, these are highly relativistic. These have energies. The temperature is very high, so these are basically moving at the speed of light. So they are on the light cone. But still, it's a pair of two charged particles, a Higgs and lepton. They are charging the SU2. And so a similar thing happened, that there is a ladder of diagrams. If you draw this before taking the cut, it's really a ladder of diagrams. So one can view this in a bit similar language as with relativistic systems, that this ladder of diagrams, it generates a potential. And so at the end of the day, one has to solve a Schrödinger equation with a certain light cone potential, which in this case, it's a thermal effect. It happens to be kind of, it's not really energy. It's like a width. It represents these scatterings. But so formally, it is a bit similar to.
So why there is no thermal contrast with
this one?
The important ones. The middle. So.
Here.
No, not these two. But for Higgs and the Feynman, there is a thermal contrast, right? But
yeah.
My question is.
Here.
No.
Here.
Yeah.
Because this is a hard, I mean, in principle, you could draw something here, but this is a, here these are, to leading order, these are just hard, these are not, so this resummation, you have to do something for things which are soft or on shell in some way. But, these guys are kind of hard, these are just hard. Here there's a phase space integration. This is some hard leptons. There's a phase space integration. And this phase space integration is saturated by hard momenta of order T. And if you have hard particles, then for the hard vertices associated with the hard particles, normally you don't need to do a resummation. But I could have also put it here. You could also just do a resummation, then a posteriori check whether you have to do a resummation or not. But I think normally here it so happens that this is a hard particle. For the hard vertex, you don't need to do a resummation.
How hard is it?
This is of momentum of order T, but here is momentum of order GT, so this is a soft one.
So you said it's, of course, so one has to resum these data diagrams, which just means sort of it would be a correction to the vertex expressed maybe in a.
Well, I think with the ladder, yeah.
Now for the propagator itself, I think it's okay to use just the hard thermal loop
Yeah.
Is there like an easy way to understand why it is okay to use it for the propagator and not for the vertex, or does one really has to follow all the details of the power counting to understand this?
Okay, so what happens here is that I think, so in principle you should use here the full half the amount of self energies and here the full half the amount of vertex. But then really the these are external states. And so this guy is now produced with my temperature is very high. So everything is non-relativistic. And so everything is produced with basically speed of light. And so this coalescence is also a collinear coalescence. It's a special collinear dynamics that's going on. These are almost collinear. They merge to one. So these are essentially massless particles merging to another massless particles in a good approximation. Therefore, they are almost collinear. So it's a specific kinematic limit that one is considering here. They're almost collinear, but with a hard momentum. Now, if one looks at these vertices and these self-energies in that limit, then one can simplify them, and that's what one always does in this case, that one looks at the special kinematics, then one can simplify the Hartzell-Mann loop energies, and therefore one gets with a kind of rather simple equation. But in principle, if one wanted to extend this resummation to a regime where you are no longer in a special kinematics, you might have to do something, you might have to have a more complete structure in the vertex and in the self-energies.
Okay, but if you are after the inclusive production rate for the right-hand neutrinos, the argument is that this procedure calculates everything correctly to leading order.
Yeah. In a certain kinematic regime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you're inclusive, so there's no kinematic regime. You integrate over all the phase states.
Well, so there is another kinematic, okay. So there's a kinematic regime where this resummation is just subleading, really high order terms. There it doesn't matter if you do it or not, if you do it correctly. But then there's another regime where it's a leading order effect, there we have to do it.
Yeah. Okay. But, I mean, the argument is that the phase space where this collinear regime, so where the Higgs boson and the lepton are not collinear, is phase space suppressed. So you don't need to resum this leading order.
No, you have to, I mean, I don't know, maybe we are talking about different things, but so, I mean, if we are in this regime, there it's a leading order effect, you have to resum them. Now this plot is for a fixed k of type of order 3 times t or so. Well, whatever. So k of order t, parametrically of order t. Now if you compute a total production rate, you integrate over k's, but you integrate with a weight which has a Boltzmann distribution. So this integral is also saturated by moment of order t. And so therefore this picture is true also for that total production rate integral. Now there may be some, I mean there's a corner, like very small case for instance, very small case where it's no longer, where something else would happen. If I would plot these curves at very, very small k, something else would happen, but that is then phase-based suppressed for the total production rate. Okay, I think I'm...
So just to understand the effects, back to the background. So somehow the final states must be losing enough energy, or the power of the organizing and gaining enough energy to enable a kinematically block process to occur.
Yeah, I mean, so the kinematics really comes from these masses. That,
right, those yeah. are what, that's the linear calculation, which is zero.
Yeah.
So you're overcoming that.
Yeah.
Bring back enough energy
to facilitate
the decay to occur.
Yeah, or the coalescence.
You have to resum all orders to get that.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, in other words, you could be also in a regime where just by counting the masses, you wouldn't think that this process is possible. But then when you add millions of scatterings, then in total they give enough energy to allow for this thing to happen. So,
is it possible to organize this in any way using a redefined theory where you resum?
So this resummation is very similar to soft collinear effective theory in some sense. one sees the same structures, the same, the propagators have the same type of structures as soft collinear effective theory, but it's not exactly soft collinear effective theory. Some power counting with this thermal, in particular the thermal gauge. And also the T, it breaks Lorentz inverse. So it's not that you cannot really, I mean, at least so far nobody demonstrated that you could take directly something over from scale.
No,
doing
a field redefinition with a consistent power count to absorb into the redefined field, the reson, some Wilson line,
I mean, this potential, of course, you can formulate in terms of those of Wilson lines. So really these are Wilson lines forming a potential. You can formulate it like that. Okay, somehow I'm kind of late. So I just wanted to show now the effect. I mean, this was somehow just with the thermal masses, and this is with this resummation. And the other day and this comes from the gauge fields. And so at very high temperatures, one gets a factor of 3 or so. And the other day we discussed whether gauge fields give a factor of 1,000 or so. So here they give a factor of more than 1,000 because it would be 0 without this, but here it's just a smooth wave. So it's a very important effect. Now, I think I want to just mention one thing. So so this resummation has to be done. It's an important part of the problem. But as usual with kind of effective frameworks, it's not the only issue. I mean, normally you have some soft part and then there is some hard part, and you have to combine them consistently to get the full result. And as usual, it can be delicate. You have to avoid double counting. And so, in fact, it's kind of interesting, but now there is a small discrepancy. Because if I understand correctly, Jörn and Pedro, they took this part. They took this part as it is, but then the hard part did differently than other people had done. And there is a small discrepancy. So there's interesting discrepancy to be resolved. But this is just to say these are kind of interesting field theory.
What's the discrepancy?
It's just a numerical factor. I mean, so it's not, as far as I know, it's not tracked down, but I mean, this is the, so everybody agrees on this enhancement. Then there is, well, it's done just the same way, but then there is a hard part which increases it even further. And these people, they get, this is like a factor of 3. In total, they get a factor of 4, whereas I think you get a factor of 4.5 or something.
So, I mean, there's this T-channel divergence from fermion exchange, the soft fermion exchange, and then you can do it analytically by calculating you calculate the hard part numerically and do the soft part analytically. That has been done by Dietrich and by us in different methods, because we had a spherical cutoff and Dietrich had a collinear cutoff. And then we also checked the numerical fit with some proper data. The discrepancy within our both results, the semi-analytical and the full numerical, is what you expect within conservative approximations, and compared to Dietrich, it's a bit on the large side, which can be understood.
So I think, I mean, this is not like a factor of 10, it's just kind of small. But I mean, I should stress that these are computations which one should view almost as standard model computation is everything. So I think these are things which we really have to, if we cannot do these things, then we cannot do more exotic things. So this is something we really have to get under control. I think, I don't really have much to say. I just wanted to say that these are somehow my basic equations. I was discussing one of the coefficients here. It turns out one other coefficient is also known with similar methods. There's one coefficient which turns out not to be important even, because so happens this is kind of, so this is kind of, this is equation as large, small, small, large, these variables in some sense. This is CP violation as is here, so it's small, this is large. But here it's large, large, small, small, because this also has CP violation. So basically this you can forget. So 2 out of 3 are known for this simplest model. Now unfortunately this one is by far much more difficult than the other ones. And however, I hope that someday we can reach kind of a similar level of understanding of that, then we have at least a very simple model for the genesis. May not be the correct one, probably it's not the correct one, but it would be nice to have also a simple one. Available if one knows the lepton number, then it's now known physics, baryon asymmetry. The rate of baryon number violation is really known now at the percent level for the standard model and so on. knows how the lepton asymmetry is converted to a baryon asymmetry down to some temperature where it's then frozen, lepton number can still do something if it wants to. But I think I just conclude, I mean, what I wanted to really stress is that there are these two, I mean, conceptually completely factorized problems. One is the problem of non-equilibrium, and the other one is this inferred divergence in the computation of some coefficients. And I think it would help to make progress if one tried to somehow factorize these two parts and then know that one is computing the same quantities with different methods. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, okay, that's the speaker.